This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. What is the new normal for immigrants in North Carolina? U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, detained at least 200 people in the state this month. In a news conference, the Atlanta Field Office Director for ICE told journalists that the more visible enforcement is a direct consequence of decreased cooperation between his agency and local law enforcement. One of the places ICE showed up earlier this month was the Bear Creek Arsenal, a manufacturing plant in Sanford. Ilana DuBester was there for the raid. She's the founder and executive director of El Vínculo Hispano, which is a nonprofit Latinx organization based in Siler City. Ilana, welcome back. Good to have you here.
It's good to be with you, Frank, although I wish it was under better circumstances.
Well, tell us, because you were at Bear Creek at a certain point, tell us, you know, sort of when you got there and what you saw.
I was on my way to work on that Tuesday morning and started receiving texts from staff and board members saying that there's a report of an immigration raid at Bear Creek Arsenal. So I drove straight there. I got there about 10 a.m. to verify that really there was a raid and be able to inform the community about what was happening. So at 10 a.m., the raid was still going on. And this was a workplace raid by HSI, Homeland Security Investigation. It was the result of many months of investigation into the personnel forms at that plant. So it was a different raid than what happened across the triangle and beyond. And at that day, so the raid ended around 1 p.m. when they took the last five detainees that left in sheriff deputies' cars. And I stayed there through the end and talked to people as they were coming out of the building that were released, let go, verified, fingerprinted, show documents of one kind or another. It didn't have to be U.S. documents. And talking to them about what was happening inside, giving out my card, offering help. So folks were coming in to pick up the belongings of loved ones that had been already detained because there were two vehicles that left around 11 a.m. as I was told. One was a van with a Walmart logo, and the other was described as a cattle car with a cage and benches where about 20-some employees of Bear Creek Arsenal were taken to be processed further away at the armory in Sanford. And that took the whole day.
Were some of the detainees in this Walmart car as well? Is that the
Yeah, that's what I was told, that they were transported in a van that had a Walmart car logo. And
what were they saying was happening inside during all of this?
They were saying that ICE was, pardon me, HSI was fingerprinting everybody and checking their record. And folks that didn't have any record were, or most of them were being released, and others were detained.
Right. I mean, this sounds like the sort of thing that we, in some ways, expect immigration to do these investigations and find out that perhaps there are undocumented people working in a certain place. This is part of the job, right?
Well, it depends. So this was an investigation specific related to document fraud. And so, yeah, that is more expected, right? And so I'm not sure what the tip was into document fraud for that particular investigation, but it was not a random ICE place, you know, a workplace raid by ICE.
Right. This had been going on for some time. Now, what about enforcement action around the triangle? What have you been hearing about that?
So after that Tuesday, the following day, and maybe even on Tuesday, ICE conducted, amassed their forces in the triangle and beyond to conduct raids in the streets, in the neighborhoods, at gas stations, wherever they could, on the roads, wherever they wanted. And as it was made explicit by ICE spokespeople from Atlanta in their press conference, that they conducted these raids in retaliation to our duly elected sheriffs in the region that decided to terminate agreements with and cooperation with ICE.
And so what, in terms of the numbers now, I guess we're hearing something like 200 people were picked
more.
Up. Do we, you know, sort of know about where they are and their status? What's your sense of what's happening to those folks?
No, and that's one of the incredibly difficult things that we face when we're working with families is trying to find their loved ones. For many, many days, even from the folks that, and for some reason, I still don't know where they are, the folks that were picked up at the Bear Creek Arsenal raid. So if they make their way all the way to Georgia, then eventually they're given a chance to call their family members to Stewart Detention Center in Georgia. They are allowed to call their family members, But otherwise, there are still people that we don't know where they are.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, ICE is charged with the finding people who are in this country without documentation and sending them back, or to get the proper documentation. That's their job. And they find people who are not and send them back. Whether or not this is retaliation for a lack of cooperation or whatever they might call it, frame it, isn't that their job?
I think what's important to keep in mind here is that we're not going to deport our way out of an immigration problem. We have 11 million undocumented immigrants from all parts of the world in this country. And until we come up with a solution to reform immigration and not criminalize these immigrants, right? Because being here, simply the fact of being here as an undocumented immigrant, is not a federal crime. It's very different when somebody has committed a crime, has been convicted of a crime, and ICE has access to that information anywhere in the country that they want. But this is not the folks that they are really targeting. The vast majority of people over the years that have been deported don't have a criminal record. And like I said, a simple violation of being here without proper documents is not a crime. It's a civil violation of immigration law. So if they have been previously deported and then entered again, then it becomes a crime, right? And so we need to look at this holistically. There is no way, and aside from being incredibly inhumane and a ridiculous strategy, to deport 11 million people from this country.
Well, I want to bring Brian Cox into the conversation now. He's the Southern Regional Communications Director for ICE. Welcome back, Brian.
Hey, Frank. Good to be here.
Let's start with this idea of this new normal, this idea that ICE will have to take a different strategy with the number of sheriffs who have been elected in their counties to renounce and not participate in 287G. What's behind that? What are you saying there?
Sure, Frank. Well, I mean, first of all, this should not be a surprise to anyone, in that this agency for more than a year has been very open to say exactly what is happening now should not be a surprise. That the bottom line is that ICE is a federal law enforcement agency that is sworn to enforce federal immigration law. And so we certainly prefer to work with our state and local partners. But the reality is that in situations where local partners are not going to work with this agency, ICE has no choice but to continue to enforce federal immigration law on its own. And so in these jurisdictions that over the past year were discussing potential policy changes, we were very open, clearly and consistently, repeatedly, saying essentially, be careful what you wish for. Because in jurisdictions that cooperate with ICE, given that this agency is focused first and foremost on criminal offenders, contrary to the comments that your guest just made, the reality is that ICE is absolutely focused on criminals and public safety threats. That for all of 2018, the local field office, which covers Georgia and the Carolinas, more than 90% of the persons arrested by ICE in violation of federal immigration law either had a prior criminal conviction or a pending criminal charge.
All right, let me ask Alana DeBester about that. We've heard this 90% figure many times. I know you have at least one story of a family in Cary that was approached, and now there's a member of the family detained. And I wonder how typical that story is and how that compares to Brian Cox's 90%.
That story is typical. So ICE came to their home, and this is a person that was released from Wake County Jail that had been in detention for about a month for driving without a license. Was picked up in Cary for driving without a license, turned into ICE. The new sheriff released him. ICE came to their door pretending to look for somebody else, and telling the family to please open the door so we can talk about, you know, reuniting this family with their children. The U.S. citizen, young woman, mother of two, who answered the door, refused to open, wanted to see a warrant, you know, was asserting her rights in all the ways that are correct. ICE called Cary PD, according to her witness to me, Cary PD for backup, and started threatening to arrest her. And she's like, arrest for what? Where is your warrant? You know, I'm not going to let you in my house. The husband was afraid for his wife and left through the back door, and ICE took him. And his only violation, aside from driving without a license charge, was having an expired DACA permit. She also said that the agents made fun of him and called him a burrito and worse names. as they were making this arrest.
So, Brian, that's the kind of thing that when we talk about, we're going to talk more about this, community reaction, the unwillingness of people to help local police, which is in large part why they don't want to help you, that these are the kinds of things they hear, and it makes their job a lot harder. How do you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I agree people make a variety of allegations, and it's very easy to make a statement such as that. The reality is that almost everywhere ICE officers go, our officers are filmed. They're filmed on a daily basis. And so these sort of allegations claiming, misconduct by this agency are made regularly. You'll note they're never made with any type of evidence. And so that sort of claim, I don't know the name of the person that's being discussed. I can't speak to that directly. But what I can speak to is statistical data. And let's be clear, ICE is in no way suggesting that persons in the country, either legally or illegally, are more likely to commit criminal offenses. Far from it. But as your other guest stated, she's exactly right. You know, there's 11, 12 million or so people in the country unlawfully. ICE is a federal law enforcement agency, is smaller than the New York City Police Department. We do not have the resources to arrest and deport everyone in the country unlawfully, even if this agency wanted to do so. And so given that reality, our focus is very clear. We are focused first and foremost on criminal offenders and public safety threats.
This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about the new normal for immigrants in North Carolina. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, made good on its warning to communities that don't participate in 287G. Program lets local law enforcement agencies partner with immigration agents. But new sheriffs elected in Mecklenburg and Wake counties ended their participation in the program. Newly elected sheriffs in Durham and Forsyth counties have announced their decisions to end the practice of honoring ICE detainers. We'll talk about that in a minute. Felicia Arriga is a professor of sociology at Appalachian State University, and she's here to let us know what else is changing in the state. Felicia, welcome back.
Hi, how are you all?
It's good. We also have with us Ilana Dubester and Brian Cox are still with us. Ilana is the founder and executive director of El Vínculo Hispano, which is a nonprofit Latinx organization based in Siler City. And Brian Cox, Southern Regional Communications Director for ICE. Felicia, what are you seeing on the ground around the state in terms of response from the community? I mean, we're hearing, all this stuff is working its way through the press, and I'm sure through other channels as well. What effect is it having in communities across North Carolina?
Sure. I think it's having at least a local effect of allowing these community members to ask questions of their local law enforcement in particular, given that there has been sort of clear indications that law enforcement has taken one stance on whether or not they're going to collaborate with ICE. And so I think it's actually opening up a lot of great conversations about the capacity for ICE to actually do this in places. And I think Brian also just sort of mentioned that there are limited resources that ICE has, right? And that's means that for a while ICE has been dependent on some of these local jails and these local partnerships to enforce immigration enforcement, whether that be through routine traffic stops or, as sort of Brian suggested, through when someone is arrested for whatever criminal convictions or charges they may be picked up on. So I think we're sort of seeing a wide array of community groups really invested in thinking about how their sheriff office is running beyond even sort of immigration enforcement. And I think that that's hopeful in some ways for what political participation looks like at the local level at this point.
And we should probably be a little more clear about how this participation has looked, because there's a couple of different ways and programs that that local law enforcement can participate in. Felicia, can you tell us the difference between 287G and honoring ICE detainers?
Sure. So I can give you sort of the short version of that. So 287G program, and I'm sure someone will correct me on this call if I mess this up, but the 287G program typically allows for some additional personnel or personnel that's already from the sheriff's office to be trained to do additional types of sort of interviews and investigations into a person's immigration status when a person is actually booked into a local jail. At this point in North Carolina, as you've already mentioned, two of the programs in the state were ended, so we now have four in the program. And this is sort of a longer history of the state at one point in time having about eight counties back in 2009 and a handful of those interested. And probably the most sort of notable one is Alamance County, who also recently attempted to reintroduce this into the county, but instead ended up going with a different type of partnership with immigration enforcement. So that's sort of the Trade 7G program allows for this other types of investigatory powers for local law enforcement, and typically they're called a force multiplier, which is different than sort of a detainer, which is information that is communicated between ICE and the local law enforcement agency, and typically ICE will request for some incarcerated immigrant to be held on a detainer for an extended period of time, and that would then give ICE time to actually decide whether or not they're able and have the resources and time to come pick that individual up from that local jail.
You know, Brian Cox, what we're hearing often from local law enforcement, especially the newly elected sheriffs, to the person, among the other reasons they give for withdrawing from the program is, we don't want to do the federal, we're not doing their job for them. We've got enough to handle as the sheriff of Wake and Mecklenburg counties. You know, the federal authorities need to do their job and we'll do ours. Mecklenburg County Sheriff doesn't arrest the president of Wells Fargo Bank when he fraudulently creates, accounts for tens of thousands of people. The federal investigators do that. So what do you say to that? Like, why aren't you doing your own job and let the local sheriffs do theirs?
Well, that's precisely what we are doing, which is why you are seeing more at-large arrests on the street. But to that direct point, this goes beyond simply ending 287G. What we're talking about in particular in Mecklenburg and Wake County, beyond not honoring ICE detainers, what we have said is, all right, local jurisdictions, if you won't honor an ICE detainer, when you have a person in your custody, particularly if they're a public safety threat, simply notify us. Simply don't hold this person 1 second longer than you otherwise would. But if you have a person in your custody, and again, in no way suggesting that persons are more likely to commit criminal offenses, but just to paint the picture, they have a blanket policy that they will not honor an ICE detainer under any circumstances, nor will they notify ICE under any circumstances. And so if you have, admittedly, a person with a violent felony conviction in your custody, due to these policies, these local jurisdictions have now chosen to release that person back into the community, which does two things. They have a period of time back in the community where they can reoffend before ICE can locate them, and it also forces ICE to expend more resources. So obviously, local jurisdictions will set local policy. At the ICE level, all we have said is, if you make decision A, B, A will happen. If you make decision B, B will happen. We prefer to work collaboratively, but if a local jurisdiction won't work with this agency, ICE has no choice but to do immigration enforcement on its own. But the reality is, it's more than, well, local law enforcement will do local law enforcement and federal will do federal law enforcement. These particular jurisdictions will not allow ICE into their facilities to do interviews to determine who these persons are, and beyond not honoring ICE detainers, they won't even notify us when a person is being released.
Ilana DeBester?
So one thing I wanted to point out and be very clear is that only 76 counties out of over 3,000 counties in the U.S. decided to participate in the 287G program. And that's because local law enforcement knows that this makes our communities less safe, makes their jobs harder, victims won't call the police for help, witnesses won't cooperate, people will be afraid to show up in court, and makes all of our communities less safe. Because whenever there is a vulnerable community, vulnerable to bad elements, then know that they are not likely to call the police, then they are going to become prey to these bad elements and increases crime in our communities. So the vast majority of sheriffs and police departments across the country are not cooperating with ICE. And they are doing that because their role is to protect and serve and not enforce civil immigration law.
Well, what about that, Brian? I mean, you mentioned the violent felon that may be in custody that they're not going to let you know about. But the violent felon is somebody who broke state law, and that is really the sheriff's jurisdiction. And they have to decide whether they have the evidence to hold them on the current infraction or not. That's a legal, requirement that they have. And their prior felony is not a reason to hold them, nor is it a federal offense. You seem to be mixing apples and oranges here.
No, I'm using it to illustrate the point of that if that jurisdiction is going to release the person on criminal charges, that If they're not going to honor the detainer, we've said, please simply notify us. And some jurisdictions have said that when they release that person from criminal custody, they're not even going to notify ICE. So that's to the point as to why you're seeing more at-large ICE arrests. Obviously, when people hear that, people are going to have different opinions. Some people may think, as a law enforcement agency, that jurisdiction for public safety reasons should notify another agency. Certain people are not. So that is somewhat of an opinion-based matter. But the reality is, when answering why persons are seeing a more visible presence, the simple answer is that up until several months ago, the majority of ICE arrests took place at county detention centers.
What about Ilana's point that the vast majority of local law enforcement are not participating in this, and for many of them will say that just makes our jobs harder? What about that, Brian?
Well, I think that we're mixing two things here. We're not talking about 287G. What we're talking about is notifying other law enforcement agencies. ICE is a law enforcement agency, and so law enforcement agencies routinely share information with each other. And so the premise that ICE is somehow different and should be treated differently than other law enforcement agencies is certainly an opinion, but it's a unique opinion. Standard practice among federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies is information sharing. That makes everyone safer. So to suggest that sharing information with ICE is somehow not good, whereas sharing information with other law enforcement agencies is, I don't understand that argument, but that's certainly an opinion-based argument that persons are entitled to have.
Ilana?
Well, that information is already being shared, because the moment somebody is fingerprinted, their name is processed through many databases, and that information is already accessible to ICE. So it doesn't make any sense that they need an extra step of, oh, please notify us. And when they already have access to that information, maybe not across the country, but certainly in North Carolina, they do.
Well, I'm going to get a particular example here. I want to share the story of a woman whose family has been directly affected by an ICE action in this state. Elena Jimenez lives in Asheboro, and ICE detained her husband in late January as he was driving to work. And here's a clip from our conversation. We talked with her earlier this morning, and we had interpretation help from Kelly Morales of Siembra NC. And my first question was to Elena, was what she learned about her husband's situation and how she learned about his detention.
Fue el martes, no recuerdo si fue 27 o 28 de enero, pero fue el martes. Yo esa mañana él iba para trabajar, yo iba a dejar al niño para la escuela.
I don't remember if it was the 27th or the 28th, but it was a Tuesday. And that morning he was going to go work, and I was going to go drop off the children at school. So since he's always going to work and I always take the children to school, he was helping by putting the children in the van. But that morning, we were running a little bit late. I didn't want to wait for him, and so I just left. And since my sister lives with me, and that morning she had an appointment in Chapel Hill for chemotherapy.
Cuando yo me fui de la casa, no baja, como es una bajada en los buzones.
When I was leaving the house, since there's a hill by the mailbox, I saw a car there. But I never imagined it would be immigration until I got to school to drop off my children. My sister called me that my husband had been detained. She told me that he was detained by police so that I wouldn't be frightened. So I came back to my house. So she gave me a call back when I was back at the house. And she told me that the arrest had been immigration. That when she was leaving for the chemotherapy, she saw that a big truck was coming to the house. And since we have two pets, the dog was barking, and my sister was looking out to see who it was. And so the officer who was coming back to drop off the keys, she realized that he was coming back to drop off the keys, but not to actually even knock on the door. He thought she was the wife. He told her, the car of your husband is down the street, and here are the keys. And that's when everything started, and he mentioned that he was immigration at that point.
Estas son las llaves. Nosotros somos inmigración. Y le dijo que ellos eran inmigración, y ahí es donde ya empezó todo. Y más tarde él...
Later on, he called me and let me know between 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. that he was detained in Greensboro at that time. And then he told me that he was going to Winston-Salem, and then from then I haven't heard anything from him. It wasn't until Thursday in the afternoon that he was able to tell me that he made it to Georgia. That's when I asked him if the detention was against him, and he told me no. They were looking for another person, but he saw a car approaching the trailer that he was loading, and I never realized that the other car approaching was going to be them. And they asked him, "Are you such person?" And they kept insisting that he was that person they were looking for. And to show him that he wasn't that person, he showed his ID to show that he wasn't that person they were looking for. And they showed him the picture of the person they were looking for, and it was clearly not him. And they told him that even if it wasn't him, they were still going to have to take him.
La persona que andaban buscando, y pues no era él, pero le dijeron que como quiera se lo iban a tener que llevar.
Elena, you said that your sister at first told you that it was the police who took him in because she didn't want to upset you. Why would it be less upsetting to know that he was taken in by the local police rather than immigration officials?
Porque
what happens is when I left the house or took the road, I saw a cop car. So I thought it was just a ticket for driving without a license. That's what I was imagining.
Was your husband ever arrested or convicted of a crime in North Carolina?
Solamente había sido.
He had never been arrested before. There were two tickets that were pending, but it was just for driving without a license. But he's never been arrested.
Y aparte, pues, parece que eran dos tickets que le habían dado por no licencia.
ICE has said that it doesn't indiscriminately or randomly target individuals, that it specifically looks for particular individuals. After this experience, Elena, do you believe that?
La verdad no creo porque ahorita se han llevado a gente.
Truthfully, I don't believe them because they've taken people like my husband. They had the picture of the person they were looking for. Why did they take my husband? Other than just for having physical appearances of being Latino.
¿Por qué se llevaron a mi esposo nada más por tener físico hispano, aspecto latino?
That's Elena Jimenez. She's talking about the detention of her husband, Carlos Francisco Curiel Ortega. Kelly Morales from Siembra NC provided the translation. Still with me, Felicia Arriaga, a professor of sociology at Appalachian State. Also here, Alana DeBester and Brian Cox. Brian Cox, what do you make of that story? Because it does sound like this was, he got swept up in what appears to be a random checkpoint.
Frank, I am so glad that you asked this question, because this is a textbook example of the type of emotional arguments that are made that are simply not accurate on the fact that this particular individual that we're talking about, his name is Carlos Curiel Ortega. He was arrested on a Tuesday. It was January 29th. The reality is that ICE was at that location looking for a different person, a different foreign national who previously lived at that address. But Mr. Curiel Ortega is, in fact, a convicted criminal. Now, I can't speak for his spouse as to whether he may not have told her that information or not, but the reality is the individual, her husband, has a 2010 conviction for DWI in the state of North Carolina. He was convicted of that charge in 2010 in the state of North Carolina. So our officers, they're looking for a person, encountered another person who admittedly is in the country unlawfully, who has a criminal conviction for DUI, and made the decision to place that person under arrest.
So I wonder if this is any part of the 90% of those with criminal convictions, DUI,
yes.
Driving without a license. So
yes.
So we can see a lot of those are
DWI
not.
DWI is a criminal conviction.
Criminal conviction. Alana DeBester, her husband is now in Georgia. There's about a $4,000 bond. Tell us about what happens when people reach you to get help to try to work with their loved ones who are in detention.
Yeah, so we are working currently with 12 families from the recent ICE raids, but we also have families from previous ICE raids. And I just want to make a point that there were three men arrested in Chatham County last year. They are considered, as ICE call it, and we call it collateral arrests. They came looking for somebody just like this woman. and they didn't find the person. They approached the first Latino-looking person they saw in the street, started a conversation. They were not wearing a uniform. They just had a little vest that said police. The men thought they were talking to a police officer or a detective that was undercover and started answering questions. And they answered too many questions and didn't assert their right and got picked up. All three men, two of the three men have absolutely no prior convictions of any kind and all are released and fighting for their right to stay in the country. So collateral arrests are very clear. So we are helping the families now with connecting them with immigration attorneys, letting them know about the Liberation Not Deportation Fund, where El Centro Hispano and Hispanic Liaison have joined forces to raise funds to help families pay for legal representation for their loved ones, and all kinds of support networks for the families as well.
Elena Dubester is the founder and executive director of El Vínculo Hispano. It's a Hispanic liaison. Felicia Arriaga is a professor of sociology at Appalachian State. She was with us, as was Brian Cox, Southern Regional Communications Director for ICE. And you also heard from Asheboro resident Elena Jimenez. And we've got links to all of this at our website, stateofthings.org. Thank all of you for being on the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank.
Thank you.
Just ahead, we talk to the author of the beloved novel, The House on Mango Street. Her latest project, Sandra Cisneros, joins us next.